Thanks, Andy. We're looking at Moses tonight, Moses in prayer, and focusing in on Exodus chapter 32 and 33. I propose to read it all, but we'll read the appropriate verses when the time comes. It's a story of a husband and wife, and the wife became quite depressed. And husband took her to the doctor, who questioned her and examined her and prodded her and all that kind of stuff. And the diagnosis was that she needed a hug every day. So he said to the husband, he said, what she needs is a hug every day. He said, certainly, doctor, what time shall I bring her in? I suspect that the relationship was quite poor in that marriage. Perhaps communication wasn't all it should have been. And because of that, the well-being of one of the two suffers. And if that's true of human relationships, how much more so is it true of our relationship with God? And the story came to mind this week, really, as I was looking at these two chapters, Exodus chapter 32 and 33, under the title of People in Prayer, and yet really aware from reading through these verses that Moses isn't just saying prayers. This isn't prayer as we've sort of been taught to say them at school or wherever we've learnt our prayers. In fact, this is more than just dialogue with God. This is lifestyle action as well. This is his faith in action from having met with the Lord. And I guess my point tonight, in a way, is that Moses is known as a man of God. Why is that? Well, I think it's because of the quality of his prayer life, his relationship with God. And that's the challenge for us. And it's been a challenge for me this week, I can tell you. As we come to look at the passages, it's the story of the golden calf. I'm sure you'll be familiar with it, most of you. And we're looking at Moses, but you know, it's not just Moses that's on display here. Not just Moses we can compare ourselves to. Because on show as well is Aaron, or Aaron, you choose, I'm not sure, and the people of God. Let's call him Aaron. Aaron and the people of God. And they've all got something in common with each other. They've all shared the same experiences in the previous few months. And they've seen God at work in marvelous, mighty ways. The Exodus from Egypt and all that came before it, all the plagues and all those things, the Red Sea parting and saving them and killing all those Egyptians behind them. They've seen sweetened water in the wilderness. They've seen manna and quail provided for them, just enough for them every day and every night. They've had water from a rock. They've been followed or preceded by clouds of smoke and pillars of flame. The Amalekites, wasn't it? I'm trying to read my own writing. The Amalekites were defeated by them, but they were just farmers, and they had spades and pitchforks and things against this army of Amalekites, and yet they still beat them because the Lord was on their side. And then they've come to Mount Sinai, and they've camped there before this mountain of God, and the glory of the Lord is there to behold in the smoke on the mountain. And actually, as we come to this bit now, Moses is up the mountain being given the Ten Commandments and the laws for the people. And the people and Aaron are left at the bottom of the mountain. Now, they've all shared these tremendous experiences of the power of God in their lives. But the contrast between Moses and the rest is just amazing. Moses is enjoying the presence of the Lord there on the mountain. And as we'll see later, you know, he comes down with his face glowing. But the people and Aaron are just bored. They're not practicing the presence of the Lord. And so they begin to drift. And they demand an idol. And Aaron just goes along with it, and they melt down the jewellery and earrings that the boys and the girls are wearing, I noticed when I read through this, and make this calf and begin to worship it. I just thought as I was reading through how easy it is to drift away from the Lord despite all the wondrous things he does in our lives. How easy it is to forget all his blessings to us. How easy it is to lose the joy of our salvation and that real sense of closeness in our relationship to him. So that's where we pick up the story, if you like. And what follows really is dialogue between God and Moses. So I guess we can call that prayer. But the result of this dialogue is that Moses actually deepens his experience of God and glows with the presence of God. And I just wonder, is that where you want to be tonight, tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc.? Deepening your experience of God and glowing with the presence of God. See what we can learn then. Because I think there's a stark choice here. We can stumble along and drift and be squeezed into the world's mould like the people were. Or through this kind of relationship with God, we can become men and women of God. First thing I think we need to see is that we need to recapture a sense of the holiness of God. I wonder if you were asked to draw a picture of God, what you'd draw. What image have you got in your mind when you think of God? How would you describe him to people? I think for many people, the image is of a benevolent, wise, probably old man with a white beard, isn't it? Nice white robes. He's a gentle being. Kindness radiates from his face and love oozes from his eyes. And he sort of screws his eyes up at you and he looks at you and he twinkles. And you know that you're loved by him. Sort of a grandfather type of person. And of course, those things are true of him. Perhaps not the image of him, but the kindness and the care and the love and the wisdom and the benevolence are true of him. But actually, they're only half the story. The other half is a half that we rarely hear about. It's a half that we rarely preach about, if we're honest. And the reason for that, I think, is because it's the half that's hidden behind the outstretched arms of Jesus. We're talking about a holy God here. The origin of the word holy, you've probably heard me say before, or other preachers say this, is simply other or different. It's what sets God apart from us. His holiness is what sets him apart because we are not holy. The word developed, the meaning developed to become that purity, that righteousness, that justness. So God's holy. He's so holy that sin can't be tolerated in his presence. He despises sin. He despises it for what it does. It spoils his creation. It spoils us. It spoils the world in which we live. It separates us from him. Because he's a holy God, and because like oil and water or the opposite poles of a magnet or whatever, you know, they just can't live in the same space. And so sin needs to be banished from his holy presence. And that's why Jesus. Because God hates the sin but loves the sinner. And Jesus, that self-offering of God himself in the form of Jesus, is a way to punish sin but to show forgiveness to the sinner through that amazing atoning sacrifice. Now, It's too easy to think of the Old Testament God of wrath and a New Testament God of love. But we're not doing that. It's not the case. This is the same God we're talking about here. The Old Testament God is a God of love. The New Testament God is a God of wrath. You'll find those descriptions of God in each of the Testaments. And it's this God of both love and wrath that came in the form of Jesus and found this way for sinners to be forgiven. He is a holy God who despises sinfulness and who hates what it does in our lives. So I just wonder whether we need to banish this image of a benevolent, kindly, matey God from our minds, at least partly. Because I think it's too easy to ignore a benevolent, kind old man on a throne. Too easy to disobey him, to walk away from him, knowing that he'll forgive us. And maybe we'd be better to reimagine, to recapture a sense of his holiness, his righteousness, his purity, his hatred of sin. Maybe we need to start thinking again about the fear of God. You see here, and we pick it up in chapter 32 and verses 7 to 10, because while Moses is up the mountain, the people have fashioned this calf. And in verse 7, the Lord says to Moses, well, in verse 6 you'll see, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings as before the calf. Afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. You can't indulge in revelry sitting down, obviously. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. They've been quick to turn away from what I've commanded them, and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They've bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and have said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt.' I've seen these people," the Lord said to Moses, "and they're a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation." Just hear this angst that God has about sinful people, his people that he's brought from slavery in Egypt and delivered in all these marvelous and wonderful ways, these people who've just turned away from him, and his anger is kindled. And remember, he's slow to anger. It's not that I think we ought to be frightened into prayer. But if we can just take our understanding of his holiness to new heights, and perhaps take our understanding of our sinfulness to new depths, then I think we can understand Christ's sacrifice in a deeper way too. We need to recapture a sense of the holiness of God. And then following that, we need to recapture a passion for his name. And there are two aspects to this in Moses' experience here. There's a boldness in prayer that he has, and there's also a holiness in lifestyle. So we look together at this boldness in prayer first. In verse 11, chapter 32. So Lord's just asked him to leave and said he's going to destroy the people, but make Moses into a great nation. And Moses sought the favour of the Lord his God. "O Lord," he said, "why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever.' Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened." See, bearing in mind all that we've said about the holiness of God and his anger burning, Moses actually, despite that, pleads with God for his people. Because he has a passion for his name. He reminds God that these are his people. These are the people he bought from Egypt. And to abandon them now will mean the Egyptians will just laugh on the other side of their faces. You see the way he reminds them about Abraham, and he reminds God rather about Abraham and Isaac and Israel. These are certainly Abraham and Israel are the names given to Abram and Jacob after they've met with God, after the covenant's been renewed with them. By using these names, he's reminding God of this covenant, this promise that he's made. You see what's going on? Moses has a passion for God's name. He has a zeal to see God's glory burning brightly in the world among the people of God. And somewhere deep within he knows that for God to destroy his people might prove his holiness in one way. But actually a better way is the original plan. For God's holiness to be shown through his people in godly lifestyles in the world. So in his prayer he reminds God of his promises and urges him to act according to his promises. And I just wonder whether in our prayers we can do the same. To remind God of his promises for this world and to urge him to act according to those promises. Then, as you'll see if you read on, and we won't read these verses, it was about God's presence going with the people as they entered the promised land. It was about a purity of lifestyle that would show the world what the people of God lived in relationship with God could be like, a new way of living. It's a passion for God's name, a zeal for his honour in the land. That's what Moses wanted. But now, well actually I think it's the same, isn't it? Our world is probably at its most ungodly and unholy that I've known it in my 50 tender and not so tender years. Ungodly values and imagery are all around us. Do you know, I've been thinking on this week, even more stuff comes to mind when you read the papers and watch the television. Soapbox time. But have you seen that program they're advertising on the telly called The Chase? It's on BBC. And they keep showing little clips before it starts. It's obviously about some extended family or other. But the advertising is, my husband slept with so-and-so and they've had a baby. You know, I've been sleeping with the butler. Or, do you know, and it just goes on and on and on in that vein. Because this, they feel, is what will attract people to watch the program. And it probably is for many people. What's that saying about who we are? About what people alike in this world, about the ungodliness in our society. I'm moving on to the second bit now, but it shouldn't be really. We need God's holy presence in our lives so that his values can be shown in the world. So are we saying that we need to remind God to keep his promises? Sounds like that, doesn't it? And it seems to be that's what Moses does. Well, clearly God will work on his own initiative. God will bring about his plans and purposes for this world according to his own perfect will. But you know what? He wants to use you and me. He longs to hear our desire to be holy in this world. He longs for our passion for his name. He longs to hear our boldness in prayer and our offering of ourselves to live those holy lives that our world can be changed. We need to recapture a passion for his name and therefore be bold in prayer. But the other aspect of that is a holiness in lifestyle. And Moses displays this holiness in his life in verse 15. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. How precious then were those 10 commandments. They were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There's the sound of war in the camp." I think Joshua was coming down the mountain with Moses. And Moses replied, "It's not the sound of victory. It's not the sound of defeat. It's the sound of singing that I hear." When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf they had made and burned it on the fire. Then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. He said to Aaron, "What did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin?" "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil." See him shifting the blame away from himself. "They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I told them, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off.' They gave me the gold and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Moses saw that the people were running wild and that Aaron had let them get out of control and so become a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Then Moses said, "You've been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he has blessed you this day." It seems harsh, doesn't it, to us today? This is one of these passages, isn't it, where people read today and say, "How can you believe in a God who sanctions the murder of 3,000 people? Slaughtered, butchered, and for what? Bit of dancing around a golden calf?" Seems a bit misguided, we might think. Dancing around the calf's a bit misguided, but to murder them. But you see, to say that is not to understand the holiness and the righteousness of God and his hatred of sin. What these people got is what we deserve. This is what Christ bore on his shoulders so that we wouldn't face this kind of butchery. This is what we've been spared from by Christ. We have a different perspective on these things because of Christ. We know the love of God and the forgiveness of God. We stand in the grace of God. But does that mean it's okay for us to sin? Does that mean it's okay for us to drift from God and follow the idols of this fallen world? The call is to a holy lifestyle, and I think it's more necessary today than ever. Did I tell you this already? I'm not sure, but I emailed the BBC about 3 weeks ago now because I was sick of hearing Graham Norton talking about the Lord. Have you watched Joseph, Any Dream Will Do? I mean, great entertainment, isn't it? And exciting when somebody gets voted off. But he keeps making this reference to Andrew Lloyd Webber as the Lord, because he's the Lord of the land. And saying things like, "Only the Lord can save him now. We have the Lord's presence with us tonight." And the first time I heard it, I thought, I suppose I smiled, if I'm honest. I thought, oh, that's quite clever. But the second time, I thought, well, actually, we should stop now. And the third time, it really, really got down somewhere deep within. So I emailed the BBC. And they promised to email back within 10 days a response to your... I was very polite, by the way. I wasn't horrible to them. But I said that it really offended my sensibilities as someone who loved the Lord. They've not emailed back. And I watched it for the first time last night since that time. And he made the reference once, at least not half a dozen times. But once. I don't know whether that's made any difference. Probably not. But just to register my protest from a desire for holiness in my heart actually made me feel quite good about things. Some of you know I've been wrestling with the whole business of being in the Spar Opera Group in these last few weeks. They're doing Sweeney Todd, the musical, this this autumn, and when they told us they were going to do it, I thought, oh, well, I've never seen that before, and it's quite a dark musical. You probably know the story of Sweeney Todd, dear, where he butchers his clients. He's a barber, butchers his clients and drops them through drops them through this sort of trapdoor, and the lady downstairs makes them into pies to eat. And good pies they are, according to the song. And I thought, well, that's okay. It's just a story. I can be involved in that. But actually, one or two of the songs have got mild four-letter words in. And one of the actresses as well, who's a prostitute, uses some clever, it rhymes, it's quite clever, clever language to describe what it is she's offering on the street. And I've just been wrestling for ages, and I think reading this week has just confirmed to me that it's not a place for me to be at this time in my life. So I've written a letter, I was very nice about it, and apologised and all that kind of stuff, but tried to express in a way that perhaps they could understand that there's enough unwholesomeness, I didn't use that word, but you know, there's enough stuff that isn't wholesome in the world without us having to add to it. And I live for Thursday night singing, but actually I think it's something that needs to be said. I mean, I don't want to sound as if I'm blowing my own trumpet here, because I think we all need to find ways in which somehow we can reclaim the holy ground and re-instill God's holy values in the land. We need to recapture a passion for his name, a boldness in prayer, and a holiness of lifestyle. And just finally, and very briefly, we need to recapture a hunger to meet with God. The next verses, again, we won't read them, but see Moses bold in prayer again. He seeks to atone for the sins of the people. He says to the people, I'm going to go now and see if I can atone for your sins. You know, he's praying to God for his people. Intercession. And I'm sure there's something we can learn from him, from intercessions. But that's not the point we need to make here. God relents and just strikes the people down with a plague, in fact. But they get off lightly, really, compared to what he was going to do. And then he pleads for God's presence to go with them as they go into the promised land. God's promised an angel to go with them, but Moses wants the presence of God. Otherwise, there's no point. If you're not with us, there's no point. And God relents and promises that he will go with them. And again, I think it would be good to learn something about God's presence being with us in the world in which we live today, about claiming the promised land that God has given us. But that's not the point we want to make here. Because all of these things are topped by verse 18 of chapter 33. After he's made these intercessions for the people and for God's presence to go with them, then Moses said, "Now, show me your glory." He's not satisfied with intercessions. He's not satisfied with boldness in prayer, good as it is. Moses wants more. He wants to experience the glory of God for himself. And the Lord didn't disappoint him. If you read verse 19, the Lord said, "I will cause all of my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I have mercy. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." You see, there's the God of mercy and compassion here in the Old Testament. "But," he said, "you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." And the Lord said, "There's a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." And the result of that, and because the new tablets are then made and so on and so forth, chapter 34, verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant, but they were afraid to come near to him. It was just obvious that he'd been in the presence of the Lord in a way that it's never been obvious about me, and I guess rarely about most of us. And I suppose the temptation is to think that Moses is some sort of a special man. But actually he was just a human being like you and me. And God, is he a different God then than he is now? No. God's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And the great need of those days was God's holiness to be displayed through his people. The glory of the Lord for all to see in the life of the people of God. And the great need for today is exactly the same. It hasn't changed. And how it came about to a point then was through that man, Moses, who recaptured a sense of the holiness of God, who recaptured a passion for his name and a hunger to meet with God. And what we can learn from Moses is the same. To recapture that sense of the holiness of God, a passion for his name and a hunger for his presence in our lives. Thanks be to God for his word.